My castaway this week is a press baron, the last, in fact, of the hereditary grandees who once dominated the British newspaper industry. He went to Eton, which he didn't much care for, joined the army in the war, where he wasn't considered officer material, and joined the family firm in 1951. He's been there ever since, and as other newspaper owners fell victim to change, he prospered. His titles have gone from strength to strength, and he now presides over the Daily Mail, the Mail on Sunday, London's Evening Standard, and a string of regional papers. He is the chairman of the Daily Mail and General Trust, Vere Harmsworth, the third Viscount Rothermere. Well, that's an introduction that begs one simple question, Lord Rothermere. How did you do it? Why have you succeeded where others have failed or are failing?
Well, I understand newspapers, and I understand newspapers in depth, and I have a great love of them.
It's a consuming passion, is it?
Oh, yes, I adore them. And also, I love innovation. I love new things. I have some instinct for what is going to happen. I have always had an ability to see into the future, and I have an extraordinary rapport with what will go down with the public.
But when you took over in 1971, the national papers that your family owned, the family silver, really, was teetering on the brink of extinction, wasn't it? This has been the great achievement, because your Daily Mail was outsold and outsmarted completely by the Daily Express, and today the opposite is the case.
I remember the occasion very, very well. Never forget it. When my father eventually refused to accept the humiliation of closing the family business, and my father resigned and handed it over to me, and he went to South Africa for 6 months, and I decided to turn the newspaper into a tabloid and change the whole marketing system of the newspaper and made David English the editor.
Do you remember the moment when you overtook the Daily Express?
Oh, very well. That was, 10 years ago. Suddenly we went above them and they went below us, and they went on falling.
And you've
and we
on
went
rising.
On rising. But I should point out that it took us 15 years to get from 1,300,000 to 2 million.
But is that the reason, is the thrill of that kind of achievement why you've gone on doing the job and running the family firm? Because, quite frankly, you didn't need to work, did you? You could have just turned your back on it all and lain down in the sun.
Well, how very boring. I mean, I couldn't imagine such a life. I remember when I was a small boy riding, my father had a most beautiful house in Kent, and we used to take me riding in the mornings. And I remember him telling me that my future would be as an officer in the Blues or the Life Guards. This was about 1935. And what a wonderful life it was, hunting and shooting and fishing and all this sort of thing. And I listened to this with a sinking heart, an utter horror, a sort of dreadful prospect that lined before me. The last thing in life I ever wanted to do.
Tell me about your first record.
The first record goes back to 1920... Although this record actually was made in 1908, but we can't get the one. There wasn't one made in 1920. The reason for that was that my great-uncle Northcliffe, who founded the Daily Mail, was so fascinated by anything in new technology. He arranged for the first broadcast of music in Britain, and this took place from somewhere in Essex and was broadcast by the BBC, I suppose, and Nellie Melba sang a piece from La Bohème.
Thank you. Dame Nellie Melba singing the aria Mi chiamano Mimi from Puccini's La Bohème, and that was recorded in 1908. I get the impression, Lord Rothermere, and maybe this is part of the root of your success, that you actually like journalists. You think they're perhaps more important than the people who manage them, do you? Is that right?
Yes, I do. Of course they're more important than people who manage them.
That's not what your father thought, though, was it? He thought you could just nip out into Fleet Street and round up another bunch of them if this lot weren't much good.
Well, I'm not sure he quite thought as casually as that. No, I don't think he did. I think he was very concerned with journalism. Indeed, he was. But he tended to pick editors who he could tell what to do.
But having said that, you have, on an occasion, called them hyenas, by which I presume you mean that they grin widely and look very pleasant, but they're not always to be trusted.
I don't remember ever calling journalists hyenas. Wolves, perhaps, but I never called them hyenas.
Do you think they're always to be trusted?
I don't think it's a profession in which you necessarily trust everybody. No, of course not.
Do you have them to dinner? Do you socialise with
Absolutely,
them?
Absolutely, yes.
But not the upper echelons. I mean, not David English. I mean, would you have Nigel Dempster to dinner, for example?
Well, I did the other day. I like Nigel very much. He's most amusing. I do. Of course I have journalists to dinner. I always have had. I like journalists. I like their company. They're very amusing. They're great fun. Obviously, you've got to be careful about what you say. And journalists tend to develop the most amazing stories about people.
Is it true that you once went to Annabelle's and were thrown out because Nigel Dempster had written something about James Goldsmith having an affair?
I read that story with great amusement. I'd never heard it before.
You weren't thrown out of Annabelle's?
Of course not.
So you never open your newspaper and read about somebody you know and think, oh dear, I'm going to have them on the phone, oh dear, oh dear.
Well, I don't, no. My grandfather, First Lord Rothermere and Lord Northcliffe were always outsiders to the English establishment. Northcliffe always took the view that to be a newspaper proprietor, you had to be an outsider. And that's my view too.
In what sense do you regard yourself as an outsider?
If you are an insider, it's very, very difficult to be immune from people approaching you and influencing you not to do this or to do that. And trying to distract your attention from your real business to promote their idea of what your real business should be.
Next record.
Now, the next record is a scherzo by Bartok, played by Zoltán Kocsis, conducted by Ivan Fischer, the beautiful festival orchestra, which I happen to be president. It is a wonderful young orchestra and will be one of the world's great orchestras.
Part of Bartok's Scherzo for Piano and Orchestra, played by Zoltán Kocsis with the Budapest Festival Orchestra, conducted by Ivan Fischer. Can we talk about your early life, Lord Rothermere? You went to Eton, but you didn't like it much. Why not? What went wrong?
Well, I didn't dislike it. I quite enjoyed it. It was in the wartime. Consequently, the masters all brought back from retirement, and they were very amiable, but I'm afraid in their dotage, a lot of them.
Bit old-fashioned.
And the atmosphere of Victorian education didn't fit my mentality, barely.
You went off to America, though, didn't you, and rather better enjoyed education there?
Yes, I was in 1940, and I was sent to a marvellous school called Kent, which my grandfather had been a patron of. This school was much stricter than Eton, but it was modern. The atmosphere was modern and very, very positive. And the education was absolutely first class. I mean, I suddenly realised what an education really was.
And were you any good academically?
Well, when I left Kent, I was really beginning to become good academically. But I then got back to Eton in 1941, and I did very well for the first year. And then this awful negative atmosphere of British education sort of seeped into one. One became sort of brain dead.
So you didn't go on to university? You didn't
even
think
of such
things?
Well, there was a war.
Yes.
This was in 1943, so there wasn't any question of going to university.
So then you joined, you did your national service. You went into the war, did you?
Yes, of course.
Did you see action?
I saw a little bit in France, but nothing really, no.
Where were you stationed then?
I was stationed in England. And then I went through France, and I went to Egypt, and I spent the last 2 years of my military service in Egypt and Palestine.
And all the time in the ranks, you weren't promoted. Why not? It's extraordinary, that.
I don't know, really. I think I was very immature, and that was quite properly not considered mature enough to be an officer.
But did you think you were officer material?
Well, I think we all automatically think that, don't we? I mean, you know, everybody starts off thinking that.
But did you have a sense of failure, therefore, that you weren't promoted?
Yes, of course, obviously. Yes, let's be honest about it, one actually does.
Tell me about record number three.
Record number three is one of Northcliffe's favourites. Now, Lord Northcliffe loved new technology. Records were new technology in his day. Radio was new. Aeroplanes were new, and he was a great enthusiast for aeroplanes, for everything to do with the air, and for records and broadcasting. And one of the first records made was Eddie Cantor singing How You're Gonna Keep 'Em Down on the Farm When Once They've Seen Gay Paree. And he used to listen to this over and over again, because he was not so much interested in the music as in the miracle of the voice being recorded.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Harry? How you gonna keep 'em away from Broadway jazzing around, painting the town? How you gonna keep 'em away from harm? That's a mystery. Imagine Reuben when he meets his pa. He'll kiss the cheek and holler, ooh la la. How you gonna keep 'em?
Eddie Cantor, how you gonna keep 'em down on the farm? The First Lady Rothermere said that when you first went to work as a young man, they put you, and I quote, in a glass box in the middle of the editorial floor with no secretary, and nobody sent you any memos, and you had nothing to do except hang around all morning waiting for lunch. Is that true?
No, it's not true, I'm afraid. I wasn't, unfortunately, on the editorial floor. I wasn't allowed to. My father didn't want me to mix with journalists, because I preferred to mix with journalists.
So your glass box was somewhere else, was it?
So my glass box, well, I didn't have a glass box. I was put into the advertising department. I worked on, first thing I did was work on postal bargains. And then I went on to classified advertising, which is one of the most important areas of newspaper work.
But very difficult, presumably, when you're the boss's son, you know, to get people to take you seriously. You don't know if they're talking about you behind your back or... Yeah, how do you cope with that?
I'm never worried what people say behind their back. I listen to other people talking about behind other people's backs. So I realise that everybody is talked about behind their back. So why is one any different? Well, it's human nature, so it doesn't bother me.
You live abroad for the most part. You've got houses in Paris and in New York. How closely do you keep in touch with your newspapers? How often do you ring up London?
Oh, every day.
How many times a day?
Gosh, I lose count. I don't know. Quite a lot.
Would you ring up and say, that was a good edition today? Or do you ring up and say, look, I really don't think you should be running these sorts of stories?
Well, a newspaper company is a very big operation, and there's a lot more to it than just the editorial. You have a whole massive operation here. You have a very big company with policies, with finance, with...
Of course,
else.
But then that's like every other business. What's interesting about the newspaper business is how much, say, the owner has or cares to have in the editorial side of the newspaper.
That's true. What I have, my way I handle this particular thing is that I insist on very high standards of journalism, being on the ball, getting scoops, being up to date, not falling behind other newspapers, all those sorts of things.
But you've agreed before all of this the politics, presumably, and you'd be very surprised if one of your newspapers suddenly started to back the Labour Party, wouldn't you?
Not in the least. It's always a possibility.
Is it?
Oh, always.
Do you think you might be backing Tony Blair for the next election?
I think that some of my newspapers might be sympathetic to Tony and others will be sympathetic to John Major. One of the things my newspapers also insist on is that the editors' politics are those of the readers.
So to be absolutely clear about this, it's possible, is it, that at the next general election, your newspapers may decide to back Tony Blair and the Labour Party?
Now, when I appoint an editor, I only appoint people who I believe to be of great talent. And people of great talent have their own opinions. And they like working for me because I let them have their own opinions.
But you're going to discuss the politics of the newspaper with them, particularly at an election. You've had lunch with Tony Blair.
Well, of course, if you are the person who decides on their salaries, they will naturally
want to know what you think.
I want to ask your opinion. I mean, even my dog does that.
Well, I'm asking your opinion. Do you think your newspapers should back Tony Blair at the next election?
I have a suspicion that some of them might.
Record number four.
Now, my fourth record is Shostakovich's Symphony No. 8. This is conducted by Valery Gergiev. He is one of the world's greatest conductors. He's very young. He will be a name as known as well as Karajan.
This is your prediction because you see into the future.
Yes.
More of that in a moment. Let's hear Shostakovich. Part of the first movement of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 8 in C minor, played by the Kirov Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. Tell me about this seeing into the future. You've mentioned Lord Rothermere. What form does it take?
Well, a lot of it's instinctual feelings, a lot of it's calculation, how I see developments coming.
But you believe in the paranormal, don't you?
Not particularly, no. I have a respect for it because I think that the existence of conscious life is a miracle of such a kind as to make every other miracle possible.
But is it not the case that you have spoken to people on the other side, as it were?
No, I don't think so, no. I haven't actually spoken to anyone on the other side.
But, well, received messages from them, then?
Yeah, well, people send me messages that I've never been to a medium. I've never had anything to do with a medium. I have heard voices occasionally, but from people I know. But
what sort of people? Saying what sort of thing?
Well, a personal message, and I hear a voice of someone I know. You know.
Someone you've known who's died?
Yes.
And what sort of messages?
Well, personal ones. You know.
Just comes into your head?
Well, I just hear it, you know. But it's very rare. I've only had it happen twice, I think, in my life.
But you believe in astrology as well, don't you?
No, I don't.
I read that you would consult the astrologer. This is a good story. Consult the astrologer of the Daily Mail, Patrick Walker, as to the date you ought to launch the new mail on Sunday, for example.
My wife was very keen on astrology, and she used to do that. And I said, well, why not? I mean, it would be, it would get the omens right, you know. I'm a great believer in omens. I think omens are very ancient. They go back into prehistory. And in the course of my life, I've seen a lot of omens. And they always mean something.
What sort of omens?
Something happens, and it's just a good omen or a bad omen, like your house burns down. My house burned down. And it means usually that your marriage, your family's going to break up. And it did, in fact, happen. And I've seen a lot of those sort of things. And they always seem to mean something.
Tell me about your next record.
Now, my next record is from Mahler Symphony No. 2, conducted by Zubin Mehta, who is one of the greatest conductors of Mahler, and I am a great lover of Mahler.
Part of the fifth movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 2, played by the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Zubin Mehta. You wrote in a poem to the first Lady Rothermere on her death a few years ago, "O Lady with the Mahler Soul," was one of the lines of that poem, and the poem was called "I Love You," and you read it out at her funeral. Am I right in thinking that you felt her rather maligned by the press? They wrote
about... very much so. She had a terrible part of her life at the end. I believe that she suffered from postnatal depression. I never heard of this condition, so one of my daughter had it and recovered from it, but she was treated for it, and I therefore learned a lot about it. And the problem with it is, if it isn't treated, it can become permanent problem.
And you believe that's what happened to the first Lady Rothermere?
I think she had it, she fought it, and she overcame it to a remarkable degree, but I think it was always there, and it undermined her whole balance, the whole mental balance, and
why did she get this image? I mean, she was nicknamed Bubbles by the press.
Oh, that was because she was full of life. I mean, she was a woman of terrific life and enormous heart.
And seemed to be
very
fun-loving, very sociable.
Yeah, very fun-loving and sociable, great fun.
Very extravagant.
But this made her more and more eccentric, more and more erratic, this thing. And, of course, that coupled with her tremendous explosive personality made her a natural target. And she loved publicity, too, so that thing was really quite a cocktail in the end.
But do you think... in the end, because she was your wife and because she was active on the social scene, as we've described, that she was fair game for the press?
I think once you put yourself on the public stage, you become a game for the press. Whether it's fair or not is neither here nor there. Life is not a fair thing.
So you're happy sometimes if journalism is unfair, right?
I think that I would seek for my newspapers to be always fair.
But I'm talking about general gossipy stuff about people in public life, which perhaps the public might be interested to read, but is not really necessarily fair game.
Should you publish the activities of well-known people, their amorous activities, what you're talking about is really an extended form of gossip. In other words, gossip which has actively gone out to find out and report it, sort of create the gossip. May be there, it's probably happening, and they're going out to actually establish that gossip is actually happening, and then printing it as a sort of factual gossip.
And that's all right, is it?
Well, personally, I don't like it. I don't.
You wouldn't seek to say, look, I don't actually approve of this?
No. I mean, I can't, because other newspapers do it, so we have to do it.
But you wouldn't like it if it happened to you, would you?
I can't recollect that it could happen to me, actually. I mean, perhaps... Well, I'm sure I've been staked out lots of times, but I don't think that...
But you've got quite a colourful personal life, you know. You ran a mistress...
And I wouldn't really mind. I mean, I don't think I would worry too much.
Wouldn't you? Don't you think it would have hurt your wife or your mistress?
Hurt my wife or my mistress?
When you were running the two in tandem.
Well, we had what you might describe as a marriage which was like that. So my wife had her friends and I had my friends, yeah.
But if it were written about at large...
It was.
Did it hurt?
No, not a bit. Not me, anyway. I don't think Pat minded very much.
So it's all fair game. We're all fair game, are we?
Well, I think printing gossip is one thing. I think staking people out is one of those things that you do because the others do it, and if you don't do it, people being what they are, they will want to read it somewhere else.
So to survive in the newspaper business, you have to be prepared to be amoral.
Well, if you call it immoral, I don't know. Well, why do you think it's immoral?
I think to go against your beliefs, to do something that you believe shouldn't be done, but to do it because everybody else is doing it, is pretty amoral.
Well, you think the whole of British society is immoral? Because that's what the whole society does.
Next record. Number six.
The next piece I've chosen is from Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto, Marga Argerich, who is one of the world's greatest pianists.
Part of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, played by Marta Argerich with the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ricardo Chailly. Are you Lord Rothermere, or have you been a great lover of the social life, as your first wife was? I mean, are you the man who always wants to go on somewhere when everyone else is heading for home?
No, I've never been a social person, and I've always wanted to go to bed rather than go out late. I mean, not when I was very young, that was rather different. But
I thought you were a great dancer and
I love dancing.
A great party goer.
I like dancing, but I am not a great party goer. I never have been, no.
So a desert island would be all right for you, would it then? It wouldn't be the purgatory it might be.
Well, I like ladies. I didn't say I would like to be alone. I like to be alone for a while, but not for too long. I mean, I do like the company of ladies very much.
And could you manage on your own? Have you ever cooked or made yourself a meal?
Oh, I'm a very good cook.
Are you?
Yeah.
And could you, you know, make yourself some clothes or build something to live
in? Well, I couldn't make myself any clothes. I might be able to build a shelter. I'm afraid I'm no good with a needle and thread or anything like that. I'd hate to be on a desert island by myself, actually. I can't think of anything worse. All right, for a weekend, perhaps, but that's about it, I think.
Tell me about record number 7.
This is Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto number 3, which is a very exciting piece. Thank you.
part of the finale of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3 in D minor, again played by Marta Argerich with the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ricardo Chailly. You own then, Lord Rothermere, three main newspapers, apart from all your provincial ones. You own a morning, an evening and a Sunday. Is that ideal, do you think, or should you be going for a broadsheet, a serious news? They're all tabloid, aren't they, these papers?
My papers, national newspapers, are tabloid, and it's very efficient to have a morning, an evening, and a Sunday because you maximise the use of your equipment. We have an enormous printing plant, which is a very ultra-modern plant. It's printed by a flexo process, and the advantage of it is that our paper, our ink, cannot come off on your hands. It's completely clean. You can read the Daily Mail, you can read the Evening Standard, and your hands will be just as clean when you put it down as when you picked it up.
Here ends the commercial. But would you like a serious newspaper? Would you like a broadsheet? Have you aspirations?
I might well do something like that one day, yes.
Which one would you be interested in?
I'd start one. I wouldn't buy one.
They've obviously given you a great deal of pleasure, these newspapers that you've made so successful. But you're 71 this year, later this year. Mm. When are you going to retire? When are you going to hand over the reins to your son?
Well, he's only 28, so that'll be quite long, and he's very able. He's running a newspaper. He's doing it very well. He's a very tough young man. He had a very tough upbringing, and he's very capable.
So when do you forecast the moment will come when you'll hand over the reins?
Well, when I go gaga.
When's that?
Oh, I should think it's already started, really, so you can tell from this interview. But
but will you be bored stiff when you do hand over?
I suppose probably, yes. That's why I don't want to do it.
Tell me about your last record.
Our last record is the Bruckner Symphony No. 9.
Bruckner's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Well, now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Lord Rothermere, which one would it be?
Well, now, I might surprise you by saying, how are you going to keep them down on the farm? Because I have a suspicion that when Northcliffe was listening to that, he was thinking, this great public who are beginning to learn about life and about what's happening in the world, how are you going to keep them down on the farm?
What about your book? Because on this island you've got the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare waiting for you.
I've never read Dante's Inferno. As a small boy, we had an ancient volume of Dante's Inferno, complete with wonderful illustrations. And I greatly enjoyed looking at the illustrations, but as the text was in Italian, I was really unable to follow it very much. And Dante's Paradise, and those I would like to be able to read.
And what about your luxury? A luxury for the man who has everything already.
Well, I thought if you're on a desert island for any length of time, one problem you're going to have is cutting your nails.
So it's a pair of scissors.
So I thought a pair of scissors would be the most useful thing you could have, because life without a pair of scissors would become very difficult. Chewing your nails is never a very satisfactory thing.
Dear Harmsworth, Lord Rothermere, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.